it's finding ways of employing people's talents in a way that challenges them, in a way that pushes them, not in a way that just is a bottomless pit and demands more and more and more of them, but demands just enough of them.
...80% of all workforce training in America is going towards safety training. It's going towards slip and fall training. It's going towards cover your ass training. It's for that reason that I think that we should be exploring in future of work how we develop skill. If we're going to really build an infrastructure in the future of work where every worker is going to be able to learn in an agile manner, to be able to reskill quickly and effectively for the next job, then we're going to have to make better decisions and choices around the technology we invest in and the strategies we invest in. For that reason, our next guest is here today, Alex Hutchinson, PhD. Started out as a physicist from the University of Cambridge. He was a researcher with U.S. National Security Agency, worked on quantum computing and nanomechanics. Did you do that too?
Yes.
He also competed as a middle and long distance runner for the Canadian national team, dabbled in cross country and even a bit of mountain running. He's a columnist for Outside Magazine and was a longtime columnist for Runner's World, a National Magazine Award winner, regular contributor to The New Yorker Online, pens the bi-weekly Jockology column in the Toronto Globe and Mail, and he writes for The New York Times. He was recently named by 538, one of their favorite running science geeks, two-time finalist in the 1500 meters at the Canadian Olympic Trials, represented Canada internationally in track, cross-country, road racing, and mountain running competitions, holds a PhD in physics from the University of Cambridge, and has worked as a researcher for the U.S. National Security Agency. Alex's latest book, Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance, grabbed my attention. Malcolm Gladwell said the book was amazing. In it, Alex says, endurance is the, quote, struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop, and that we're always capable of pushing a little farther. You might say, what does endurance running have to do with the future of work? Well, you know what? I've seen a lot of jobs today, and if you ever worked at an Amazon plant, that's a pretty big test of endurance, if you ask me. So I want to talk to Alex today about what some of his learnings were in his exploration and writing of the book as he really double-clicked on the concept of endurance in athletes, and see if there's any connection between developing high-performing athletes and developing high-performing workers. So with that, here's Alex Hutchinson. Let's bring it in.
Alex, I guess to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I guess I would describe myself these days as a science journalist, or maybe even a science of sport journalist. It's become my niche over the last decade or so. My background is I was a competitive middle distance runner for the Canadian national team. And I also was a scientist. I started out in physics, did a PhD, and worked as a researcher for about a decade, and then shifted into journalism, merging those two areas of interest, sports, or particularly endurance sports, and science. And yeah, that's I write about research into human performance, and also in, you know, health and fitness and more generally, but really interested in the evidence base, like what. Not what do we think we know, but what do we actually know, and with what level of certainty?
Sure. I love you know, your book Endure, which I have right, you know, in front of me, all marked up, has got me thinking a lot when I get on the Peloton these days. The pain I feel, I process it a little bit differently. I hear you, like the words in your book encouraging me.
That's excellent to hear. And yeah, hopefully that, at the moment when you're about to give up, you hear a passage saying, you know, yeah, it hurts. It is just your brain deciding you're getting up. It's not that your legs are going to fall off, and that doesn't make it easy. But for me, at least, that's the key insight from the book, is just that failure is a decision, not failure, but reaching your limits is a decision. It's an epiphenomenon in your brain, and it's very few of us die because we push too hard on the Peloton.
There's one quote in, says, endurance is the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. When you went through the process of writing the book, what were the takeaways you hoped that readers would glean from the experience?
Yeah, I mean, it really started out as, in a sense, an attempt to understand you know, my own track career? Why wasn't I faster? What was it that in those races where I was good but not quite good enough that stopped me? And it really evolved away from the sort of, oh, it's all about my lungs or my heart or my muscles, and it ended up being a book almost entirely about the way the brain interprets signals from the lungs, the heart, the muscles, but also your coach, your peers, your, you know, how you're feeling about things. So the real takeaway for me was that was an epiphany for me, and I think for a lot of other people, hopefully it will turn out to be the same, that realizing that it's our perception of things that dictates our response to it rather than the things themselves. And, you know, ultimately you end up sounding like I'm regurgitating, you know, Buddhist philosophy, which in a sense says some of the same things, but yeah, that's the real takeaway for me. And I think it's also, as time has gone on, I've realized that it's not just about how you run a race, but how you approach challenges in other parts of your life too, whether it's your career, your personal life, how you, just the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop is a very general thing that we all experience.
Could it be said that, I guess, what separated when, you know, in your research, what separated truly, you know, top tier athletes from the rest? You know, I would assume it's not just maybe some level of skill or natural born talent. I mean, what in your research maybe was surprising?
Yeah, one of the sort of questions I wrestle with is, you know, okay, it's not all in your head, but it's not all in your body either. But what's the balance, right? Like what separates it? And I think it depends on, so the way I think about it is, if I took 100 random people from the street and had to place bets on them for running a marathon, I was allowed to gather whatever information I could. I would take them to a lab and I would test their physiology. I would test their ability to process oxygen to their muscles, because at that level, with a group of heterogeneous people, it's the physical stuff that really matters. It doesn't matter how mentally tough I am. I'm not going to beat the Olympic marathoner or the Olympic marathon champion, because we're different species almost. But once you take a group of people from a similar context, let's say you take all the people who have already qualified for the Olympic marathon or you know, whatever the case may be, then the physical characteristics are much more similar. And so then this is where these factors like, how much are you willing to endure? How much are you willing to push? How much are you willing to suffer? They become much more important. So, you know, it's not that, it's never all one or all the other. It's just like nature or nurture in biology, right? It's not that people are born to their fates and no one can change anything, but it's also not correct to say that anybody can become the world chess champion if they just practice. People have different aptitudes and different skills. And you know, some people have natural aptitude for certain tasks and others for other tasks. So yeah, I'm rambling a little bit, but the point is you have to consider the physical reality, but also how you respond to that reality and what you're able to do with your opportunities.
What are the implications for coaches, you know, or maybe, you know, managers in the workplace who are trying to, you know, workers are running a really long race every day, if you kind of maybe think about it that way as well, that's tough. But are there any implications for coaches or advice for coaches that you think maybe comes out of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, in a way, the great coaches or the great managers have already intuited the things that I'm going to say, right? Like some people already... And in the same way that great athletes already know anything a sports scientist can tell them, they've already intuited it. So I think the key thing is that one of the most important things you can do for people you're leading or managing or coaching is create in them a sense of positive self-belief, that they're capable of achieving the goals you've set out for them. And you know, this is an argument in favor of positive leadership as opposed to negative leadership, because there's some really fascinating research, which, you know, I do just discuss in the book about how physical limits can be changed by the words you say to people, the facial expressions of people around them, when you're feeling more positive about things, you're more willing to keep pushing because you believe it's possible and it's worthwhile, and you have self-efficacy, meaning that you believe you're capable of doing this thing, therefore you're more willing to work hard to do it, so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think, you know, in the sports context, you can talk about, like, there's running workouts you can do where the coach, you know, deceives the runners into how fast they're running, and they end up realizing, oh man, I'm capable of more than I thought it was. You can't translate that directly in the workplace. You know, you can't lie to your employees about what they're doing. Say, hey, you produced 7 more memos than you thought you did. But I think the general principles are similar, that you want to try and find ways of supporting the belief that people are on track to achieve their goals. Within the bounds, if they're not, you have to tell them that too, but you want to make them confident that they're capable of doing it if they do the right things.
Yeah. I mean, it's so simple, but it's kind of so important right now, right?
And I think that's a really important point, the simplicity of it. And so one of the big things for me was that I spent like 10 years working on this book, and I talked to, you know, hundreds of researchers, and I came out with these radical conclusions. And I'm like, oh, wait, in the mid 90s, when I was a college athlete, we had a sports psychologist working with our track team who was telling us all this stuff already. And you know, stuff about negative thought stopping and about positive belief and self-talk motivation. And at the time, in the mid-90s, we just laughed at the sports psychologist. We were all, you know, 20 years old and thought we knew everything. We didn't care about what she had to say. And I look back and it's like, but she was telling us everything that I'm now like writing in my book and saying, look at this radical new breakthrough. So it's a really key distinction between, you know, understand, like, the messages are simple, but the messages themselves don't do anything unless you buy in. And so for me, part of this book was a journey of like looking at the empirical evidence and saying, oh, wait, no, you know, not every self-help message is useful, but some of them are right on the money. And so I had to then, in a sense, I had to believe the messages that I was reading about belief before they became useful. So I think it is simple. And that's actually one of the hardest things about it, because you say some of this stuff and everyone's like, yeah, 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 okay, I know that, or it can't be that easy. And so I think it's worth, you know, thinking really carefully and looking at the evidence about, you know, things that you can talk about it in the context of things like growth mindsets and things like that. And understanding that the belief that you can do better is a key prerequisite to doing better.
Yeah. Carol Dweck was definitely like ringing in the back of my mind at different times.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of similar messages in a completely different context, but it's the point is the same, that if you don't believe you can get better at something, that doesn't mean it's true, but it does mean it's going to seem like it's true, because you're not going to put in the effort to get better.
Yeah. What was your favorite chapter?
You know, a lot of this stuff was, I'd been writing about the science of endurance for a long time, so I already knew a lot of the physiology I wrote, but there were some areas which were totally mind-blowing to me. The one that sticks out was I wrote a chapter on to what extent is oxygen truly limiting for athletes? Like, when you're out of breath, does this actually mean you're about to die, or is it just a warning signal? And I talked, you know, I wrote about high altitude mountaineers, but I also wrote about free divers. And that free diving led me into the world of like breath holding, extreme breath holding. And that stuff just blew my mind. That, you know, it's just, for the record, the world record for holding your breath without any tricks, like, you know, magicians, they'll pre-breathe oxygen, pure oxygen and stuff, so that they can hold their breath longer. But just, you know, just ordinary dude, hold your breath, 11 minutes and 40 seconds. And that, you know, it's just, so as soon as I read that, I'm like, okay, I'm going to see how long I can hold my breath. And you're like, you get to, I don't know, for me, a minute and a half. And it's just like, it's like so unpleasant. It's just inconceivable that someone could do it for 10 times longer. And then I had after I wrote the book, I had a chance to interview the North American record holder for breath holding, who he had just set, a guy named Brandon Hendrickson from Olathe, Kansas, I think. And I was asking him about it, and it's like, what changes? It's not that his lungs get bigger or anything like that. What changes is his understanding that when it feels like crap, that's just a feeling. And so you have to then just ignore that feeling. So it's extremely unpleasant to hold. I think Brandon held his breath for like 8 minutes and 35 seconds, something like that.
Wow.
And yeah, it was like, it was really, really, really unpleasant for the last 4 minutes. But yeah, you know, he learned that, hey, it's a warning signal I can ignore.
Yeah. It's like the thing you said earlier that limits are a decision, right?
They're a choice. This is one of the researchers whose work I really describe a lot in the book. He has this sort of psychobiological theory of endurance. And that's one of his sort of the fundamental tenets for him is that the moment of failure is a conscious choice. It's a decision. You decide that you're no longer capable of doing it anymore. It's probably the right decision in 99.99% of the cases, but don't kid yourself that it's not a decision. You're choosing to slow down, to clock out, whatever the case may be or the context.
Sure. I mean, from a thinking about, some of our audience being workforce leaders and folks that wake up every day thinking about how do we get the most out of our people that show up to work. I just see so many parallels between, running a race and, sprinting through a workday or a long work life, like that's happening for so many workers globally today. Are there any, and as I raise that to you, are there any parallels or that you see between the research and maybe powerful advice for HR leaders out there today who are trying to do that?
Absolutely. I do think there are parallels. Maybe the most important one is actually kind of the opposite of the message of the book. The book is all about push, push, push. How do you suffer more? There's an important caveat to that, that you can't just keep pushing indefinitely if you want to have achievement in the long run. So I guess for people who are leading workforces right now, the last message I would want them to take away is that if you give a fiery enough speech and get people to buy in, you can have people work until they literally drop dead of exhaustion. That's not helpful, but it's not good for the workers, but it's also not good for productivity overall. So there's a section of the book that I think is really fascinating on mental fatigue, which is, and the protocol they used is actually pretty relevant. They use 90 minutes of focused attention at a computer screen. So your screen, there's letters flashing the screen, you're clicking buttons depending on which letters show up. And what they find is after spending 90 minutes doing that, your physical performance is harmed by 15%, which is the equivalent of, you get the same effect if you would do like 100 drop jumps. So something that totally smashes your muscles. You know that your muscles are messed up, but you get as much of a performance decrement if you do this 90 minutes of close work on a computer, that you don't realize it. That's the dangerous thing. You're mentally fatigued. And they also, they do simulations of this. It's not just physical performance. Your cognitive performance, your decision-making, your reaction time, all these things are harmed by mental fatigue, but it's kind of like carbon monoxide. You don't realize that your performance is being poisoned. And so I think this is a real, once you understand that it's the brain that determines, the limits of your endurance, then you realize that actually you really need to respect the brain. The brain can help you push harder sometimes, but you also need, if you want to be performing at your best, if you want to be getting the most out of your workers, you need to make sure that they're not doing 7 hours of like extremely hard work. And then at that point, you're expecting them to make a good decision or, not miss a crucial detail. Because at that point, their performance is down the tubes. So anyway, there are a lot of ways of analogizing it, but I think understanding the limits that are imposed by the fact that it's your brain is also really important.
Yeah, it's almost the mental, and I think about the varying levels of mental fatigue associated with different workers within maybe a single brand. If you're working on the front line, you probably have a lot more, you're clocking in the morning with, a lot more, you're like coming out of a workout already, all day long, versus a worker who may be in a corner office whose journey to work that day maybe was not as stressful, like varying as a manager trying to lead folks that have, not everybody starting the race with the tank, the same full tank, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And the specific demands of different roles and in different contexts, you have to have some sort of appreciation of what's reasonable to expect from someone, and not just for their sake, but for your sake. If you want them to be performing at their best, what are some allowances that you might be able to make to say, hey, I realize that you're mentally fatigued, or you're physically fatigued, or you're just emotionally and motivationally fatigued, or whatever the case may be.
So what's the next book?
You know, it's we're sort of bordering on it. This is why some of my answers. Endure was all about how you push harder, and now as a 45-year-old trying to figure out what the rest of my life is all about, I'm trying to explore why we push harder. Why?
Yeah.
You know, why I feel like I need another next challenge, and you know, beyond paying the rent, and I think it's a hard question. So I'm thinking about like why are we driven to explore to push?
That's great. I think that, I mean, that's really timely. Again, I'm coming from like the workforce side, but you know, we see workers coming unstuck from brands right now because of why do I do this every day? Like why the pandemic shifted people's, you know, perspective of where they want to spend their time.
Yeah, that's you know, it's interesting. And I started thinking about this before the pandemic, but boy, it's like intensified as I'm like, look, what am I doing and why? And, you know, rather than fight it, I want to understand the sort of the evolutionary and neuroscientific origins of like, why are we wired this way? Why are we wired to push? And what is the dangers of pushing, of not understanding those impulses in the modern world where we're not eating antelopes, we're chasing, you know, whatever promotions.
Well, that's fun. Yeah, I'd be, you know, excited to see what the outcome is. I tell one of the books from this, one of the stories from the book I tell is the, I think it was early in the book. It was about, it's almost like the splits. I think it was on maybe 100 meter or 200, oh,
yeah.
You know.
When I was getting the wrong times and that's it's really the origins of my interest. I think it's like the way that being deceived, and if we could harness, if we could, this, I guess I was saying that a little bit in the interview. It's like if you figure out a way of trick people like that systematically, it'd be great. But it's not. You can't just lie to people gratuitously. So I got lucky that someone lied to me in just the right way.
Well, Alex, thank you. I got one more question for you. You know, the so much about what we're talking about is around the future of work. I think that. You know, like you just mentioned, there's so much that people have to think about today in order to get the best out of their team every day and individually, whether it's positive thinking or otherwise. I want to ask you, what is your hope when you think about the future of work?
Yeah, you know, one of the issues I've been thinking a lot about lately is the question of kind of meaning and challenge, and making sure that the people who are most satisfied in their career, they have a why, like you know they're doing it for a reason, and they're challenged. You know, one of the things people talk about with flow, right, is you need to have a challenge that's at the sort of utter edge of your capabilities, but it's not so hard that you can't do it, but it's not so easy that it's rote. And so I think, you know, in a utopian future, or you know, in terms of a direction we want to go, it's finding ways of employing people's talents in a way that challenges them, in a way that pushes them, not in a way that just is a bottomless pit and demands more and more and more of them, but demands just enough of them that they're that they're using their talents and they're being challenged without being sort of squeezed dry.
Alex, thanks for taking time.
Thanks, Sam. I really appreciate the opportunity to have a chat.
In Alex's book, Endure, he said this: reaching your limit is a decision. And there's a lot of different things that come to mind when I hear that out loud after reading Endure and the conversation with Alex. As I think about our workforce, think about the limits that humans can stretch themselves physically and mentally, and really to understand that so much of our performance is tied to our mental capabilities more so than our physical ones. I think about managers who every day have the opportunity and responsibility to invest in their people, to develop them into not just better workers, but better people. And the choices they make decide whether that is an actual outcome or not. I think about workers who, unfortunately, in America, so many are working jobs that aren't able to work from home, who are getting up and going to work in environments where physical labor is still real, who are reaching their limits and still also stretching themselves, not just physically, but mentally and emotionally. I also think about the quote from Alex that said this in his book: top athletes really push themselves to a darker place and stay there longer than most people are willing to tolerate. It's the responsibility of managers, leaders, organizations, government to create environments where their people can thrive. I look forward to a world where we stop calling humans resources and we start considering them as the people that they are, who every day wake up and fill their day with activities that, you know, in some cases they get paid for. In some cases, those activities are for leisure. But the very definition of work is changing. And the construct that has become work is really being challenged as, in many ways, just a number of activities that our community and society values and at a certain level will in turn compensate for. But as we've seen over the last year and a half of a global pandemic that has challenged our economies and challenged how businesses operate, and challenged the way companies treat and incentivize labor, I think that a lot of what Alex has to say and Alex talks about is really scratching the surface of a conversation all of us leaders should be having more frequently, which is around how can we challenge our workers? How should we challenge our workers? Because it's not really an issue of if they're capable. It's a matter of what ways we should be doing it in, why we should be doing it, and how we should be supporting our people as they move and thrive through our workforce. Now, don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not going to want to miss. Now, back to work.